afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. This is the second half of a two-hour program with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small. And if you missed the first half, you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And, we're here most every week trying to bring you things that are educational, things that you wouldn't hear else in other places, and things that get relegated to...
A soundbite.
Let's see. I saw Dr. Small on a Fox News channel in some other town, San Diego, I think it was, after the shooting. And I think it was a 5-minute clip, which was actually kind of a lot of time. But when I heard him down at the Israeli consulate, he did about a 15, maybe 20-minute presentation. And I thought, okay, that was way too short. way too short. So he is the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, ISGAP for short. ISGAP.org is the web location for that, or you can look up charlesashersmall.com. And just to cut to the really, I just thought it was the fun part of his bio, he has served as a consultant and a policy advisor in North America, Europe, South Africa, and the Middle East. So pretty much... he's running the world. We're just going to shorten it to that. Charles Asher Small, and he's running the world. We'll get into. I'll make a note about the Russia thing. Let's not muddy the water. Okay, so we had a story on the table with you, Dr. Small. I was asking about how you have all these Islamic studies things at Oxford that are kind of big. And then there you are discussing anti-Semitism and how a lot of these guys are promoting things that are anti-Semitic. How do you split up the campus? You guys have a fence down the middle, or you wear colors like the Crips and the Bloods?
Almost. It's getting to that. So basically at Oxford, I did my doctorate there, and I have some friends that I stay in contact with. And essentially, Oxford and England at this moment is actually, it's going through a very difficult time. I would say it's almost become a cesspool of hatred and recrimination and anti-Semitism, particularly at the universities and certainly within the government. I think Jeremy Corbyn is a walking poster child for some of the problems that we're facing in Western democratic countries, including the United States, where you have sort of a left-wing politician who's in bed and is being paid and sponsored by the Iranian Revolutionary Regime. He worked for them, funding and friends from the Muslim Brotherhood. So you have, on the extreme left, this very strong relationship that goes back decades to the Muslim Brotherhood, and you have somebody like Yosef Kawadawi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, who starts Islamic studies at Oxford University. And this is a man who calls for all believers to finish the work of Hitler.
Yikes.
And this is a man, yes, he didn't wake up in the morning and had a bad day to say this. This is a part of a central element of the Muslim Brotherhood's ideology. They amalgamate a very narrow vision of Islam with European fascism and Nazism. And this is who they allow to create Islamic studies at Oxford. And
wow.
To make a long story short, some friends of mine who were professors, and now they run the International Studies program at Oxford, were interested in our proposal. We were actually trying to get it into our program into an Ivy League university in the United States, and the opposition was so difficult, we were having a hard time finding a home for it in the U.S., So my friends asked to see the proposal, and they liked it, and they accepted it at Oxford. And sure enough, within about 2 weeks of the program being accepted, professors from Middle East Studies and other kind of Islamists and leftists started to protest against the administration for allowing a Jewish Zionist project into the university. So there was a lot of opposition, and actually friends of mine threatened to resign in the name of academic freedom and freedom of speech if the university was going to shut the program down, because it was a serious academic program. We have professors from, top universities from all over the world teaching professors, so it was a serious program. And My friends who are liberals, who are not Jewish, really stood up for democratic freedom. And they prevailed. And when they accepted the program under this sort of fraught moment in the politics of Oxford, I invited every administrator or professor from Oxford to sit in on our program and to, you know, they would see that we were doing something that was at high levels of scholarship. And they came in and they, you know, they passed by and they realized it was a serious seminar. So that was 5 years ago. And in the past 5 years, with the increased threat of anti-Semitism to the democracy in England, and with Brexit and the rise of so anti-democratic politics, we are getting more and more support because we frame our program within a framework of protecting democratic principles and human rights. So we're getting, we have more friends and supporters in Oxford these days, and I think more and more people realize in Europe that anti-Semitism is a threat to the way of life of the democracies in Europe. And there's, I think, a robust defense of democratic principles and also the fight against hatred against Jews and other minorities emerging in Europe. And it's time that these issues also, I think, become front and center in the United States, because we have some of these, the so-called extreme left and the radical Muslim alliance is now affecting politics in this country. And I think we need to become, as a society, very much aware of what's at stake, not just to the Jewish community, because that's the distraction. The anti-Semites want you to look at the Jews and the Israelis and the Zionists, and while your gaze is at the Jew, these people are affecting your universities and now Congress and our policies. And we need to become fluent in the ideology of political Islam and why the extreme left is in bed with the Islamists and their push to change society here.
You spend a lot of time studying this. We've done the concept of political Islam, for anyone who listens to our program, is not a new idea. We have done dozens of shows on this topic. So that part isn't a comprehension stretch for anybody. But I guess what is a big stretch for most people is why would... And maybe this is one of those, you know, rhetorical who the heck knows questions, but why does the extreme left, who supposedly wants special rights for everyone, feel that it's okay to demonize one group of people? Do you see any is there any trend showing up?
It sounds like the whole Zionist idea is where they have the problem. Is that it, or is just a part of it, or what?
So I think, look, anti-Semitism runs deep into our culture in the West. And here you have sort of this reactionary social movement, meaning the political Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and the Iranian Revolutionary Regime, the Shiite world, sort of emerging with this... very narrow interpretation of Islam, interwoven with European notions of anti-Semitism and of Nazism, and it's powerful. And then on the left, you have this sort of intellectual moment. You have postmodernity and the left intellectuals of Edward Said and Michel Foucault and sort of postmodernism, where notions of good and evil are thrown out the window. All narratives are equal and need to be represented. So you have this sort of anti-Western, anti-Zionist, anti-neo-imperialism, left-wing ideology that also has something in common with the extreme Muslims. The extreme Muslims want to destroy the state as a vestige of European colonialism. They want to rid the so-called Islamic world of Jews, of Christians, of capitalism, of socialism, anything Western. And you have these kind of, I don't know, left-wing, progressive, I think that's a misnomer, but people who identify as that, who are against American hegemony and American intervention and Western intervention in the world, and they want to join the Palestinian cause to rid the Zionists of the region. And it's a horrifically I don't even have the words, but there's a hypocrisy that's so deep. And when people act irrationally and with such profound hypocrisy, I think one of the issues clearly affecting this behavior is a deep-seated anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, not able to accept the self-determination of the Jewish people in their homeland. And it's ugly.
And that actually sort of makes it make sense. How about this? We need to take a really quick break, and when we come back, I'd really like to, let's continue on this Palestinian issue, because that is always at the core of it, and I think it's fundamentally misunderstood as well. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Guest Dr. Charles Asher Small, the founding executive director for the Institute and Study of Global Anti-Semitism and Policy. And you can find more information about that at isgap.org. Okay, so now we've kind of gone into the liberal mania and the Palestinian thing, and that just seems to be their coalescing point, that the Jews are, you know, being mean to the Palestinians, so now suddenly defending the Palestinians is the cause of choice, I guess. And that seems to be fueling a lot of the anti-Semitism, just from what it looks
I think that's one of the doors they used to open up this whole thing and shed, you know, a bad light on Israel, which I don't think is fair.
So if you were going to defend that or fix it or explain it, maybe, I don't know if explaining it's possible, but when you see all of that, if you could sit them all down and give them a talk, what would you tell them?
Right. So it's a very complicated, complex issue, but I would say at one level it is kind of simple. The Palestinian National Liberation Movement was taken over or kind of emerged actually out of the Muslim Brotherhood. So this is a reactionary social movement that perceives Jews as subhuman, as emanating from apes and pigs and from the urine of donkeys. This is literally from their, from their intellectuals. This is the garbage that they espouse. And I think once you have a social movement that dehumanizes human beings, that doesn't see that every person or every human being created an image of God, and there's something sacred about every life of every individual. When you debase somebody to the point that they become, the imagery is that they're not human and they're kind of animal-like, it's a very difficult and dangerous ideology. So here you have a social movement that doesn't see their opposition as fully human. And they can't recognize the other. So at one level, I think we in the West, we want equality, we want the underdog to be respected and taken care of. And, you know, I think Palestinians deserve some form of self-determination. They deserve good, peaceful lives, as does everybody else. But their liberation movement has been hijacked by this movement that wants to literally calls for the extermination of another group. So it's a very difficult process. And then people who don't understand the ideology and the mission of this movement, I think well-meaning people on the left in the West, and or well-meaning people not just from the left but from Western countries, are rooting for the underdog. And they want some sort of just solution. But I think what I would urge people to do is to really understand the ideology and the objectives of this movement, and it's one of destroying democracy and liquidating the Jewish people, not even just the state of Israel, but the Jewish people, sort of using this Nazi ideology and imagery.
Yeah, and it's hard to sit down at a bargaining table when you know that's their platform to start with. How do you negotiate from that point? It seems impossible.
Yeah, so I would say you cannot. There's a very important philosopher named Emmanuel Levinas, and Levinas was born in Lithuania. He was a student in France. He was doing philosophy in France, and his entire family was exterminated and brutally murdered in the Holocaust in Lithuania. And because he was a student in France, he managed to survive. And he went on to become one of the 20th century's greatest philosophers, and he was a philosopher dealing with ethics. And he said two profound things for me when I read him and studied him. He said that the moment we see our face in the face of the other, that's the instant we become human. Mm-hmm. So the minute we see our face in the face of the other, that's the moment we're human. And we need the other, in a sense, to become human. We have to be ethical to the other. And this is the cornerstone for any civilized society. However, he also goes on to say that if a social movement or a political ideology dehumanizes people as the cause of disease, as the cause of all the problems in the world, or gives them animal-like characteristics, he also argued that that's an ideology that must be completely destroyed, destroyed intellectually and destroyed militarily, destroyed. Because you can't negotiate with a movement and with people who think they're dealing with others who are not human. So this is a profound challenge. So I don't think you can negotiate with people who are sitting down with the other who don't see them as human.
No.
And this ideology is espousing that clearly. This is, and I think if you go online to read the Hamas Charter, if you go online to read the founding fathers of the Muslim Brotherhood, like Qutb and al-Banai, it's there. It's there in black and white.
Right. And that being said, is I think people can understand why there are no talks going on. I mean, you can't
well, every
sit across,
time you do it, all of a sudden they're lobbing bombs.
Yeah. You can't sit across the table from somebody that has that ideology or those ill thoughts towards you to start with. I mean, that has to be neutralized before any talks can even begin. So I think that's the uphill struggle, and it's been that way for forever over there, hasn't it?
It's been like that for a long time. That's true. I said, but I think it's also important to point out that the G7, the United States, the five countries that negotiated this deal with Iran transferred billions of dollars of cash and trade deals and all sorts of things to get them to sign this deal over their so-called nuclear weapons program. And here you have money that was sent by the United States and sent by European countries that has been used in death squads by roaming militias in parts of Iraq and Syria, killing, hundreds of thousands of people. So our money being used in a war is being waged by people who have this ideology. And we naively, I think, believe that, if we give them money, if we bring them into the family of nations, they're going to change their ideology and they're going to become more peaceful or more Western or the like. And this results in catastrophes.
No,
clearly.
That's why I think the whole premise of a two-nation solution, it can't work if one side has those beliefs. You're basically just going to give them a launching pad to continue their bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. I If I could wave a magic wand, I would like to have a two-state solution where both the Israelis and the Palestinians were good neighbors living side by side in a peaceful arrangement in a peaceful region. It would be wonderful. And I think that the resources and the ingenuity, and it could become an amazing part of the world, that could contribute much. But I unfortunately agree. You can't negotiate with people who want to exterminate you. There's no negotiation. Mm-hmm. Hopefully one day the Palestinians will have a responsible leadership that will really be intent on a rapprochement and recognizing Israel and the Jewish people's rights in their homeland, and I'm certain the Israelis would reciprocate, and they ought to reciprocate if that was the situation.
So with that, getting back to the United States, what do you see as a first good step in solving this situation with Palestine? Is there something we're doing that we shouldn't be doing, or something we should be doing that we're not?
So it's a great question. I think what we should be doing is becoming more aware of the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood and the sort of red-green alliance, and then I think also the reaction to it that's also emerging. I think as a society, I believe it was Jefferson who said that the greatest threat to democracy was the ignorance of the citizens. And today there's a threat against our democratic country coming from the extreme green, the Muslim Brotherhood and its proponents, and this sort of acquiescence by our intellectuals and our human rights community to this threat. And we see with Congresswoman Omar entering Congress and espousing the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we are not fluent in the minds of our enemy. We don't know what she was saying. And she said horrific things about the United States. She said horrific things about the Jewish people based on Muslim Brotherhood ideology. And we in the Democratic Party and we in the Jewish community, we excused her. With a sort of, I would say, a paternalistic, liberal form of racism. You know, she doesn't know what she's saying, or she didn't mean it
that way. Right. I love that one. That's my favorite.
But here is a woman. She is an immigrant. She came to this country, and in a very short period of time, gets educated and becomes a leader of her community. She makes it to Congress. And she's a smart, intelligent, capable American citizen. And all the power to her, but to say that she's ignorant and stupid and she doesn't mean what she says is astounding. And that's unethical. She knows what she's saying. She's espousing an ideology. And the fact that she could, like a hot knife going through butter, divide the Democratic Party and the Jewish community in a couple of weeks shows how ignorant we are to this threat. And I think we need to understand where she's coming from and what kind of support she's getting and from who, like CARE, which is also a front for the Muslim Brotherhood, and how she's supporting the demonization, not just of Israel, but Jewish American citizens and anybody who supports the Jewish community in this country. So it's dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
We're going to come back here in a couple of minutes with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small, and I want to talk a little bit about how this plays out in the long run for a democratic form of government, because you had talked about that in the meeting I sat in previous, and it was a scary idea. We will be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Talking about Congressman Omar and the hate speech that she spews almost daily and gets away with, and how the left doesn't say anything to her. And I think that really illustrates how effective that type of speech is, and how easily it is to sway, like you said, half of Congress is maybe not going along with it, but they are going along with it.
They're not saying anything,
and that's going along with it. I think that's something that we really need to address in our highest house of government. How we can let that continue.
No, I agree very much with you, and I think we need to become more literate and more understanding of the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood and their tactics, because they can demonize the Jews, and many of us, if we're following the political debates of the day, a lot of us will dismiss that as perhaps she has some sort of problem, or it's a problem for the Jewish community, and some of us agree or disagree, but what's interesting is that the anti-Semitism is always a distraction for anti-democratic forces. They focus on the Jew while it's like the puppeteer. You look over there, you look at the Jew, you look at the anti-Semitic tropes about the Jew, you look at the anti-Semitic tropes about the Zionist or the Israeli, and you're focusing on the victim of this hatred. But while your gaze is over there, on the other side, just like the Nazis and just like what the Muslim Brotherhood does throughout the Middle East, they change in the most brutal way institutions and society. And they're anti-democratic, they're sexist, they're anti-Semitic, they're anti-minority, and they want Islam in a very narrow form of Islam to be the dominant and only acceptable view of a diverse great religion. And when we give these people a pass in the Democratic Party, when we give these people a pass at the university, we're setting ourselves up for a catastrophe. And you can look at the Middle East, it's on fire. There's millions of people being killed, there's millions of refugees. The migration crisis through Turkey entering into Europe, there's a backlash against this crisis. I think there's an awakening of nationalism and even racism and white supremacy as a reaction to the silence of the human rights community and the intellectual community, which has been perhaps bought and sold in part by this very dangerous ideology. So this is a threat to democracy. And I'll just say, a couple of weeks ago, there was a 24-hour period where I think this sort of culminated. You had the New York Times cartoon depicting Netanyahu having Donald Trump on a leash, and he was blind in this anti-Semitic cartoon, and that Netanyahu was leading the blind Trump into war. 12 hours before that, you had Zarif, the head of the foreign minister of the Iranian Revolutionary Regime, saying that the Jews are tricking President Trump into a war in the Middle East against Iran. So you have the New York Times and radical extremists in Iran with the same message. And then just hours after that, you have an attack by the gunmen in San Diego. So you have extreme white nationalists, liberal New York Times, and the foreign minister of Iran, all espousing the same anti-Semitic trope, and its roots are the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Its roots are the same in European anti-Semitism and fascism. And here it is, alive and well in our global discourse today.
Yeah, it's frightening, and it's going unchecked. That's what just blows my mind.
It is going unchecked because we're not allowed to talk about transgender. We're not allowed to talk about LGBT. We're not allowed to, all those things. If you bring up any of those things, you're bad.
Oh yeah, and you're destroyed.
Anything about black on black crime? Oh, you're a racist. Can't talk about that. All these things you can't speak about, but this is just hangs in the air.
And it's just allowed to go on.
You had made a really excellent point, and I know this will run us into another break, but definitely we can't finish the show without discussing it. You had made a point that just will stick with me forever. A couple of months ago when you were kind of giving us that brief overview, and you had said that every time that this happens, your system of government ultimately falls. And I thought, holy crap, you're right. I mean, What's the logical conclusion? And what do people like Omar and that other stupid woman. I know there's so many, right?
Yeah.
The other one who escapes me at the
Talib.
Moment. Yeah. That one. So, I mean, what they basically want is socialism. Same, too, with Ocasio-Cortez. But that's what they're after, is socialism. So, is this the precursor? You know, we usher in radical anti-Semitism. We glorify the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then we flip over our source of our form of government.
Right, yeah. So should I respond or wait? To
yeah,
the
no. Go ahead. I'm done ranting. Sorry.
No, so I think it's a serious threat when the Muslim Brotherhood is basically, we call it an anti-systemic movement. It's an anti-modernizing movement. It's anti-modernization. It's anti-enlightenment. It's anti-democratic. And that's, you know, at one level, you could sort of understand it and why it emerges and why it's gaining strength in certain parts of the world. But the amazing thing and the intriguing thing is, why would progressive people, in quotations, support a movement that's anti-democratic, it's anti-American, it's anti-Western, it's anti-equality? So here you have people on the left, intellectuals on the left, and politicians who claim to be on the left, who are supporting the agenda of Omar or the Muslim Brotherhood, like President Obama was supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood. He goes to Cairo. The State Department helped them organize in the elections several years ago. They enter into negotiations and exchanges with the Iranian Revolutionary Regime. So how do people who are progressive and liberal also get into bed and have an alliance with an anti-systemic, anti-democracy, anti-capitalist, anti-American, anti-European movement? And this, to me, this contradiction is very dangerous and profound. And why is the left silent when Omar represents a movement that's not just anti-Semitic, that's disturbing in and of itself, but this is a movement that wants to subjugate women.
Right.
According to the Muslim Brotherhood, adult women cannot go out into public spaces unaccompanied by a male member of their family. So here you have progressive women in the universities, you know, professors and human rights activists and leaders of industry who are sympathetic to Congresswoman Omar. But these are women who would stand up fiercely, I'm sure, if you would ask them, should a woman be equal under one legal system in a democracy, I'm sure they would say yes. And yet they're supporting a sexist agenda. You know, these are people that also believe that gay people should be killed.
Right.
These are the type of
right.
people that...
It's not a rights issue. It's a life issue.
Exactly. It is. It's in democracies, we believe in the notion that every citizen must be equal under one law. The Muslim Brotherhood does not believe that. They don't believe in the idea of citizenship. They don't believe in the idea that everybody's equal under one law. There's certain laws for practicing Muslims. There's certain laws for practicing male Muslims. There's certain laws for women. And there's lesser laws for the dhimmi, the protected religious minorities like Christians and like Jews, who are not full citizens under their vision of the caliphate and of society.
Now we get to convert or pay the tax or die.
Exactly.
Those are the choices.
How can progressive people be... How can we even consider that? It's beyond.
I keep thinking it's got to be that same mental disconnect. I mean, really, it's if we could get a little psychiatry update.
Pick and choose, you know, the ideas they like.
But I think they think it's just like socialism. The reason socialism hasn't worked in other parts of the country or other parts of the world is that they did it wrong. We're going to do it different, and it'll be better here. So maybe if the Muslim Brotherhood's primary tenants take over, it's going to be different here.
Right.
Which is really just crazy.
Right. If we're nice to them, maybe they're going to become like us.
And that's worked out really well.
Right, and we don't have to understand their worldview. We don't have to respect their worldview. We don't have to understand that it's rooted in a deep worldview that includes religion and philosophy and politics and military strategies. These are intelligent people. But we don't have to study it. We don't have to learn about it. We don't have to understand their language and their mission and their ideology, because if we treat them well, they're going to be like us. If we treat them bad, they're going to be at war with us.
Well, that was President Obama's whole thing, was if we just went around the world, apologized to everybody, and we were super, super nice.
They'd all come to the table and everybody
be better.
And
Trump's a big monster because he threatened to put tariffs on Mexico. But, that actually worked, which is causing them all sorts of problems. That blows the whole paradigm. We've got to take a really quick break again. Darn it. Love capitalism, but it's so intrusive. Shoot. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small. We are We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back. Sort of glossed over the how does this all turn out in the end if left unchecked?
Yeah, how has it happened in the past?
So if you could put on your, you know, if this was a Swami session, you know, and you're the guy wearing the Swami hat, what does the future look like if this goes without any pushback?
So I can't look into the future.
Oh, come on. That's what we told everybody you did. You're running the whole world. We already know this.
Right. I forgot.
Every continent, except Russia.
So what I would say is you can look to Europe. And if you look to France and Belgium and the United Kingdom and other countries, you have... I say an influx of migrants, many of which harbor anti-democratic and anti-Semitic ideas and beliefs and a worldview, and they are not being integrated effectively into society. So you have parts of Paris and Brussels and now London that are very difficult spaces for Jews to enter, for women to enter, for couples to walk in ways that we're accustomed to, because these are areas in which people are trying to implement formally and informally a way of life that is antithetical to democratic societies and to cities where democracy was actually born. And I think that this is dangerous and is causing a backlash against migrants and immigrants, which is unfortunate as well. So there's, if you look to Hungary and Greece and Romania and also to France, I think we also, because of the human rights community silence on this reactionary social movement, now there's also a reaction starting, I think, of extreme nationalism and even racism in Europe and also in North America. So there's an attack on our democratic principles from the extreme right and white nationalism, from Islamists, and from the extreme left. So the center is under attack. And I think those who believe in democratic principles, we have to understand why this is happening and to find ways to safeguard it and to give our citizens a good education in democratic principles and civic ideas and democratic principles.
Yeah, because in you know, history shows that once this process starts, if it goes unchecked, your society is doomed. It will eventually fall into chaos and war.
Well, in the first hour, you brought up a really good point that it didn't just destroy the Jewish population, which it did by the millions, but it also physically destroyed giant swaths of Europe and killed zillions of people. I don't even know how many people were killed, but we just
millions.
Just recognized D-Day, and obviously those images should be fresh in everyone's mind, and that all started with ideas.
Exactly. And I think you could look to the Middle East, where these horrible ideas have gained traction over the last decades. Old fascist Nazi forms of anti-Semitism and of ideas of governance. And you could look to the region, and it's imploded, and there's horrific carnage and destruction in the name of creating some sort of utopian religious society. You know, they talk about the Jews and Israel and Zionism, and that it's very anti-Semitic, but they're killing their own Muslim brothers and sisters. So it's dangerous, and this implosion of civility and of governance is now, you know, it's at the doorstep of Europe, and it's a great challenge for European democracy, and it's also going to be a challenge for democratic countries in the Western Hemisphere, including the United States.
Oh, it's knocking on the door here, and I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that want to take a run at it. They want to let it, give it a try, give it a test drive, see how it's going to work out. And once you start down that road, bad things are going to happen. And I think every time in the past, I mean, how has it turned out? How has it turned out when...
Bloodbath.
Yeah.
Basically.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when you... because, you know, as a... I mean, I joke about it, but I don't know that many people who have consulted and helped with policy in... You know, North America, that's a big place. Europe, large place. South Africa and the Middle East. I mean, that's quite a swath of the world that you have had the ability to consult with and influence. The one place I see that is very much missing is the Russia and that whole area. Russia, China. Is there any interest there at all? And I see one of your colleagues is doing some speaking regarding Russia here this month, I think.
Yeah. So we touch on issues in Eastern Europe, Ukraine, and Russia in our summer school at Oxford, but it really hasn't been the focus of our research for various reasons. It's I think the urgent area was the Middle East and radical Islam and its acquiescence on the left. But these issues are also very important. We have a colleague named Sam Sokol, we're doing a book launch for his book on Thursday in our center in New York City, and he just wrote a book about Putin's war against the Jews and looking at the politics of Russia and Ukraine. And he's a scholar and a journalist with a lot of experience sort of there on the ground in the war. And he's looking at propaganda, Russian propaganda and Ukrainian propaganda, and how the Jews are being used by both sides. So it's a fascinating book.
Hmm.
Or the image of the Jew
sure.
is being used.
Well, we had somebody called in to bring up that the United States is a representative republic and not a democracy, which, of course, we know. We were talking about the idea of democratic forms of government around the world, really, kind of as a whole big basket, because not all of those are representative republics.
Correct.
And that idea of freedom of speech and those types of things, not the representative form of government, but the form it takes all over the world, where you get to debate ideas and all that. That all blows up when this anti-Semitism takes hold. And, you know, Dr. Small, what's your thought on, you know, you push people to the wall. You know, you let in all these immigrants who have no intention of assimilating. They come with all these radical ideas. That does, on the, you know, on the other side, create some nationalism just because people feel like their country's, you know, sliding away.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that can be avoided, I guess, if we just started bringing in immigrants the right way? Seems like an easy fix.
So I think immigration is a key strength to American society and Canadian society and many other societies. Immigration is,
sure,
is a wonderful thing, but it needs to be governed well. And also, having said that, I think, you know, there's international law when it comes to refugees, that people have a legitimate, according to international law, a legitimate claim to they have a legitimate process to claim refugee status. There should be a fair and speedy hearing. And if they are true bona fide refugees, they have a right to enter the country where they initially land as a refugee. And if they're deemed not to be refugees, then they're deported. And it should be an orderly fashion. And people should have the right to this process. But having said that, I also think that a failed foreign policy on these issues also plays a role. So, for example, I remember the red lines during the Obama administration in Syria, and I think many refugees and immigrants don't want to leave their homeland. So there was a threat. There was a model that was being floated that there should be a safe zone within Syria. For displaced people, they would be protected by Western countries. It'd be a no-fly zone, and refugees can sort of wait in a corner of Syria and be helped by the international community and then repatriated in their villages and cities when the war was over.
Yeah.
But, of course, that didn't happen. So I think we need to have strong...
It didn't even happen force. A little. I mean, that wasn't even like it... It wasn't even like it failed. It just never...
Never materialized.
Yeah, it just never showed up.
And then you have Erdogan in Turkey, who's now, you know, very much engaged in the Muslim Brotherhood and maybe even a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, kind of turning on and off the flow of refugees entering into Europe as he tries to, I think, you know, swindle Europe out of resources and power, kind of turning the tap on and turning the tap off of refugees. So it's a mess.
It is a mess. And when you wind up with unchecked immigration, you look at the mess it created in Germany. You look at the mess in, I mean, just to pick specific cities, Paris and London. They've got some serious problems. I don't know how they solve that. I mean, London has had some no-go zones for, gosh, I remember we talked to a guy in London 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And they already had carved out parts of the city that even the police didn't get to go in.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you speak about that, you get into trouble as well.
That's why he comes on using a fake name.
Yeah.
I mean, which is pretty darn bad that you're not even allowed to say, hey, you know what, this isn't really working out.
And
that's also part of the problem.
Yeah. I think we should remember that the vast majority of immigrants and refugees are grateful for having the opportunity to have a second chance at life and to live in these countries. Most are hardworking people, but yeah, you know,
but it's pretty easy
really
to exploit. Yeah, when you see that wide open door, it's pretty easy to exploit for nefarious purposes.
Oh, definitely.
And we've made it as easy as possible. Hopefully that changes soon. All right. So we have run out of time, as I knew we would, darn it. Our guest today has been Dr. Charles Asher Small. We thank you so much for coming on with us and for educating us on all these really, really important topics.
Thank you. It was a big honor to be with you for 2 hours and to be your guest. So thank
it takes
you.
2 hours, for heaven's sakes. This is a big, big topic. So we hope folks will send this to their friends and family. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.